They reached a place where the narrow corridor they'd been following branched into diverging paths. That low, steady buzz was coming from the left-hand one, and not very far up it either, by the sound. It was now impossible for them to walk side by side, and as they worked their way toward the end, the passage grew narrower still. Ralph was finally obliged to begin sidling along. The reddish exudate Atropos left behind was very thick here, dripping down the jumbled stacks of souvenirs and making little puddles on the dirt floor. Lois was holding his hand with painful tightness now, but Ralph didn't complain.
"It's like the Civic Center, Ralph. He spends a lot of time here."
Ralph nodded. The question was, what did Mr. A come down this aisle to commune with? They were coming to the end now. It was blocked by a solid wall of junk, and he still couldn't see what was making that buzzing sound. It was now starting to drive him crazy. It was like having a horsefly trapped in the middle of your head. As they approached the end of the passage, he became more and more sure that what they were looking for was on the other side of the wall of junk which blocked it. They would either have to retrace their steps and try to find a way around, or break through. Either choice might consume more time than they could afford. Ralph felt nibbles of desperation at the back of his mind. But the corridor did not dead end. On the left there was a crawl space beneath a dining room table piled high with dishes and stacks of green paper and... green paper? No, not quite. Stacks of bills. Tens, twenties, and fifties were piled up in random profusion on the dishes. There was a choke of hundreds in a cracked gravy boat and a rolled-up $500 bill poking drunkenly out of a dusty wine glass.
"Ralph, my God, it's a fortune!"
She wasn't looking at the table, but at the other wall of the passageway. The last 5 feet had been constructed of banded gray-green bricks of currency. They were in an alleyway which was literally made of money, and Ralph realized he could now answer another of the questions that had been troubling him. Where Ed had been getting his dough? Atropos was rolling in it, but Ralph had an idea that the little bald-headed son of a bitch still had trouble getting dates. He bent down a little to get a better look into the crawl space underneath the table. There appeared to be yet another chamber on the other side, this one very small. A slow red glow waxed and waned in there like the beating of a heart. It cast uneasy pulses of light on their shoes. Ralph pointed, then looked at Lois. She nodded. He dropped to his knees and crawled beneath the money-laden table and into the shrine Atropos had created around the thing which lay in the middle of the floor. It was what they had been sent to find. He hadn't a single doubt about it, but he still had no idea what it was. The object, not much bigger than the sort of marbles children call croakers, was wrapped in a death bag as impenetrable as the center of a black hole. "Oh, great! Lovely! Now what?"
"Ralph, do you hear singing? It's very faint."
He looked at her dubiously, then glanced around. He had already come to hate this cramped space, and although he was not claustrophobic by nature, he now felt a panicky desire to get away, squeezing into his thoughts. A very distinct voice spoke up in his head.
"It's not just what I want, Ralph. It's what I need. I'll do my best to hang in with you, but if you don't finish whatever the hell it is you're supposed to be doing in here soon, it won't make any difference what either of us want. I'm just going to take over and run like hell."
The controlled terror in that voice didn't surprise him, because this really was a horrible place. Not a room at all, but the bottom of a deep shaft whose circular walls were constructed of rickrack and stolen goods, toasters, footstools, clock radios, cameras, books, crates, shoes, rakes. Dangling almost right in front of Ralph's eyes was a battered saxophone on a frayed strap with the word Jake printed on it in dust-dulled rhinestones. Ralph reached out to grab it, wanting to get the damn thing out of his face. Then he imagined the removal of this one object starting a landslide,
that would bring the walls down on them, burying them alive. He pulled his hand back. At the same time, he opened his mind and senses as fully as he could. For a moment, he thought he did hear something. A faint sigh, like the whisper of the ocean in a seashell. But then it was gone. If there are voices in there, I can't hear them, Lois. That damn thing is drowning them out. He pointed at the object in the middle of the circle. Black beyond any previously held conception of black. A death bag which was the apotheosis of all death bags. But Lois was shaking her head. No, not drowning them out. Sucking them dry. She looked at the screaming black thing with horror and loathing. That thing is sucking the life out of all this stuff piled up around it. And it's trying to suck the life out of us, too. Yes, of course it was. Now that Lois had actually said it out loud, Ralph could feel the death bag, or the object inside it, pulling at something far down in his head, yanking at it, twisting at it, shoving at it, trying to pull it out like a tooth from its pink socket of gum. Trying to suck the life out of them? Close, but no cigar. Ralph didn't think it was their lives the thing inside the death bag wanted, nor their souls, at least not exactly. It was their life force it wanted, their ka. Lois's eyes widened as she picked up this thought, and then they shifted to a place just beyond his right shoulder. She leaned forward on her knees and reached out. Lois, I wouldn't do that. You could bring the whole place down around our... Too late. She yanked something free, looked at it with horrified understanding, and then held it out to him. It's still alive. Everything that's in here is still alive. I don't know how that can be, but it is. Somehow it is. But they're faint. Why are they so faint? What she was holding out to him was a small white sneaker that belonged to a woman or a child. As Ralph took it, he heard it singing softly in a distant voice. The sound was as lonely as November wind on an overcast afternoon, but incredibly sweet as well, an antidote to the endless bray of the black thing on the floor. And it was a voice he knew. He was sure it was. There was a maroon splatter on the sneaker's toe. Ralph at first thought it was chocolate milk, then recognized it for what it really was. Dried blood. In that instant, he was outside the red apple again, grabbing Nat before Helen could drop her. He remembered how Helen's feet had tangled together, how she had stumbled backward, leaning against the red apple's door like a drunk against a lamppost, holding out her hands to him.
Give me my baby. Give me Ali.
He knew the voice because it was Helen's voice. This sneaker had been on her foot that day, and the drops of blood on the toe had come either from Helen's smashed nose or from Helen's lacerated cheek. It sang and sang, its voice not quite buried beneath the buzz of the thing in the death bag. And now that Ralph's ears, or whatever passed for ears in the world of auras, were all the way open, he could hear all the other voices of all the other objects. They sang like a lost choir. Alive. Singing. They could sing. All the things lining these walls could sing, because their owners could still sing. Their owners were still alive. Ralph looked up again, this time noting that while some of the objects he saw were old, the battered alto sax, for instance, a great many of them were new. There were no wheels from gay 90s bicycles in this little alcove. He saw 3 clock radios, all of them digital. A shaving kit that looked as if it had hardly been used. A lipstick that still had a Rite Aid price tag on it. Lois, Atropos has taken this stuff from the people who'll be at the Civic Center tonight, hasn't he? Yes, I'm sure that's right. He pointed at the black cocoon shrieking on the floor, almost drowning out the songs all around it, drowning them out as it fed on them. And whatever's inside that death bag has something to do with what Clotho and Lachesis called the master cord. It's the thing that ties all these different objects, all these different lives, together.
That makes them quartet. Yes. Ralph handed the sneaker back to Lois. This goes with us when we go. It's Helen's.
I know.
Lois looked at it for a moment, then did something Ralph thought extremely clever. Pulled out 2 eyelets worth of lacing and tied the sneaker to her left wrist like a bracelet. He crawled closer to the small death bag and then bent over it. Getting close was hard, and staying close was harder. It was like placing your ear next to the motor housing of a power drill shrieking at full volume, or looking into a bright light without squinting. This time there seemed to be actual words buried within that buzzing. The same ones they'd heard as they approached the edge of the death bag around the Civic Center.
Ralph, off, beat it.
Ralph placed his hands over his ears for a moment, but of course that did no good. The sounds weren't coming from the outside, not really. He let his hands drop again and looked at Lois. What do you think? Any ideas on what we should do next? He didn't know exactly what he had expected of her, but it wasn't the quick, positive response he got. Cut it open and take out what's inside, and do it right away. That thing's dangerous. Also, it might be calling Atropos. Have you thought of that? Tattling, just like the hen tattled on Jack in the story about the magic beanstalk. Ralph actually had considered this possibility, although not in such vivid terms. All right, he thought. Cut open the bag and take the prize. Except just how are we supposed to do that? He remembered the bolt of lightning he'd sent at Atropos when the little bald creep had been trying to lure Rosalie across the street. A good trick, but something like that might do more harm than good here. What if he vaporized the thing they were supposed to take? I don't think you can do that. All right, fair enough. As a matter of fact, he didn't think he could do it either. But when you were surrounded by the possessions of people who could all be dead when the sun came up tomorrow, taking chances seemed like a very bad idea. An insane idea. What I need isn't lightning, but a nice, sharp pair of scissors, like the ones Clotho and Lachesis used to... He stared at Lois, startled by the clarity of the image. I don't know what you just thought of, but hurry up and do it, whatever it is. Ralph looked down at his right hand, a hand from which the wrinkles and the first twists of arthritis had now disappeared, a hand which lay inside a bright blue corona of light. Feeling a little foolish, he folded his last 2 fingers against his palm and extended the first 2, thinking of a game they'd played as kids. Rock breaks scissors, scissors cut paper, paper covers rock. Be scissors, he thought. I need a pair of scissors. Help me out. Nothing. He glanced at Lois and saw her looking at him with a serene calm, which was somehow terrifying. Oh, Lois, if you only knew, he thought, and then swept that out of his mind, because he had felt something, hadn't he? Yes, something. This time he didn't make words in his mind, but a picture. Not the scissors Clotho had used to send on Jimmy V, but the stainless steel shears from his mother's sewing basket. Long, slim blades tapering to a point almost as sharp as the tip of a knife. As he deepened his concentration, he could even see the 2 tiny words engraved on the metal just south of the pivot point, Sheffield Steel. And now he could feel that thing in his mind again. Not a blink this time, but a muscle. An immensely powerful one, slowly flexing. He looked fixedly down at his fingers and made the shears in his mind open and close. As they did, he slowly opened and closed his fingers, creating a V that widened and narrowed. Now he could feel the energy he had taken from Nirvana Boy and the bum out at the train yards, first gathering in his head and then moving down his right arm to his fingers like a cramp. The aura surrounding the extended 1st and 2nd fingers of his right hand began to thicken and to lengthen, to take on the slim shape of blades. Ralph waited until they had extended themselves about 5 inches out from his nails and then worked his fingers back and forth again. The blades opened and closed.
Go, Ralph, do it.
Yes, he couldn't afford to wait around and run experiments. He felt like a car battery that had been called on to crank a motor much too big for it. He could feel all his energy, the stuff he'd taken as well as his own, running down his right arm and into those blades. It wouldn't last long. He leaned forward, fingers pressed together in a pointing gesture, and sank the tip of the scissors into the death bag. He'd been concentrating so hard on first creating and then maintaining the scissors that he had stopped hearing that steady, hoarse buzz, at least with his conscious mind. But when the scissors point sank into its black skin, the death bag suddenly cycled up to a new shrieking pitch of mingled pain and alarm. Ralph saw dribbles of thick, dark goo running out of the bag and across the floor. It looked like diseased snot. At the same time, he felt the power drain inside him roughly double. He could see it, he realized. His own aura running down his right arm and across the back of his hand in slow, peristaltic waves. And he could sense it dimming around the rest of his body as its essential protection of him thinned out. Hurry, Ralph, hurry! He made a tremendous effort and tore his fingers open. The shimmering blue blades also opened, making a small slit in the black egg. It screamed, and two bright, jagged flashes of red light raced across its surface. Ralph brought his fingers together and watched the shears growing from their tips snap shut, cutting through dense black stuff that was part shell and part flesh. He cried out. It was not pain he felt exactly, but a sense of awful weariness. This is what bleeding to death must feel like, he thought. Something inside the bag gleamed bright gold. Ralph gathered all his strength and attempted to open his fingers for another cut. At first, he didn't think he was going to be able to do it. They felt as if they'd been stuck together with crazy glue. And then they drew apart, widening the slit. Now he could almost see the object inside, something small and round and shiny. Really, only one thing it can be, he thought. And then his heart suddenly fluttered in his chest. The blue blades flickered. Lois, help me! She seized his wrist. Ralph felt strength roar into him in big, fresh volts. He watched, bemused, as the shears solidified again. Now only one of the blades was blue. The other was a pearly gray. Lois screaming inside his head, "Cut it! Cut it now!" He brought his fingers together again, and this time the blades cut the death bag wide open. It uttered one last wavering shriek, turned entirely red, and disappeared. The shears growing from the tips of Ralph's fingers flickered out of existence. He closed his eyes for a moment, suddenly aware that big warm drops of sweat were running down his cheeks like tears. In the dark field behind his eyelids, he could see crazy afterimages that looked like dancing scissors blades. Lois, are you okay? Yes, but drained. I don't have the slightest idea how I'm supposed to get back to those stairs under the tree, let alone climb them. I'm not sure I can even stand up. Ralph opened his eyes, put his hands on his thighs above the knees, and leaned forward again. Lying on the floor where the death bag had been was a man's wedding ring. He could easily read what had been engraved on the wide inner curve. H.D. E.D. 8587. Helen Deepnow and Edward Deepnow, married on August 5th, 1987. It was what they had come for. It was Ed's token. All that remained now was to pick it up, slip it into the watch pocket of his pants, find Lois's earrings, and get the hell out of here. As he reached for the ring, a flicker of verse slipped through his mind. Not Stephen Dobbins this time, but J.R.R. Tolkien, who had invented the hobbits Ralph had last thought of in Lois's cozy, picture-filled living room. It had been almost 30 years since he had read Tolkien's story of Frodo and Gandalf and Sauron the Dark Lord, a story which contained a token very similar to this one, now that he thought about it. But the lines were momentarily as clear as the scissors blades had been only moments before.
One ring to rule them all, one ring to find them, one ring to bring them all, and in the darkness bind them, in the land of Mordor where the shadows lie.
I won't be able to pick it up, he thought. It will be as tightly bound to the wheel of Kaa as Lois and I are, and I won't be able to pick it up. Either that, or it will be like grasping a live high-tension wire, and I'll be dead before I know it's happening. Except he didn't really believe either of those things was going to happen. If the ring was not his for the taking, why had it been protected by the death bag? If the ring was not his for the taking, why had the forces which stood behind Clotho and Lachesis and Dorrance, he couldn't forget Dorrance, set him and Lois upon this journey in the first place? One ring to rule them all. One ring to find them, Ralph thought, and closed his fingers around Ed's wedding ring. For a moment, he felt a deep, glassy pain in his hand and wrist and forearm. At the same moment, the softly singing voices of the objects, which Atropos had hoarded here, rose in a great harmonic shout. Ralph made a sound, perhaps a scream, perhaps only a moan, and lifted the ring up, clenched tightly in his right hand. A sense of victory sang in his veins like wine, or like... Ralph! He looked at her, but Lois was looking down at where Ed's ring had been, her eyes dark with a mixture of fear and confusion. Where Ed's ring had been, where Ed's ring still was, it lay exactly as it had lain, a glimmering gold circlet with HDED 8587 inscribed around the inner arc. Ralph felt an instant of dizzy disorientation and controlled it with an effort. He opened his hand, half expecting the ring to be gone in spite of what his senses told him. But it still lay in the center of his palm, neatly enclosed within the fork where his love line and his lifeline diverged, glimmering in the baleful red light of this nasty place. HDED 8587. The two rings were identical. One in his hand, one on the floor. Absolutely no difference. At least none that Ralph could see. Lois reached for the ring which had replaced the one Ralph had picked up, hesitated, then grasped it. As they watched, ghost gold glowed just above the chamber's floor, then solidified into a third wedding band. Like the other two, HDED 8587 was inscribed on the inner curve. Ralph found himself thinking of yet another story, not Tolkien's Long Tale of the Ring, but a story by Dr. Seuss, which he had read one of Carolyn's sister's kids back in the 50s. That was a long time ago, but he had never completely forgotten the story, which had been richer and darker than Dr. Seuss's usual jingle-jangle nonsense about rats and bats and troublesome cats. It was called The 500 Hats of Bartholomew Cubbins, and Ralph supposed it really wasn't any wonder that the story had come to mind now. Poor Bartholomew was a country hayseed who had the bad luck to be in the big city when the king happened by. You were supposed to take your hat off in the presence of that august personage, and Bartholomew had certainly tried, but without any luck. Each time he took his hat off, another one, identical to the last, appeared beneath it. Ralph, what's happening? What does it mean? He shook his head without answering, eyes moving from the ring on his palm to the one in Lois's hand to the one on the floor, around and around and around. Three rings, all of them identical, just like the hats Bartholomew Cubbins had kept trying to take off. The poor kid had gone on trying to make his manners to the king, Ralph remembered, even as the executioner had led him up a curving flight of stairs to the place where he would be beheaded for the crime of disrespect. Except that wasn't right, because after a while, the hats on poor Bartholomew's head did begin to change, to grow ever more fabulous and rococo. And are the rings the same, Ralph? Are you sure? No, he guessed he wasn't. When he'd picked up the first one, he'd felt a deep, momentary ache spread up his arm like rheumatism. But Lois had shown no signs of pain when she picked up the second one. And the voices. I didn't hear them shout when she picked up the one she has. Ralph leaned forward and grasped the third ring. There was no jolt of pain and no shout from the objects which formed the walls of the room. They just kept singing softly. Meanwhile, a fourth ring materialized where the other three had been. Materialized exactly like another hat on the head of hapless Bartholomew Cubbins. But Ralph barely glanced at it. He looked at the first ring, lying between the fork line of his lifeline and love line on the palm of his right hand. One ring to rule them all, he thought. One ring to bind them. And I think that's you, beautiful. I think the others are just clever counterfeits. And maybe there was a way to check that. Ralph held the two rings to his ears. The one in his left hand was silent. The one in his right, the one that had been inside the death bag when he cut it open, gave off a faint, chilling echo of the death bag's final scream. The one in his right hand was alive. Ralph? Her hand on his arm, cold and urgent. Ralph looked at her, then tossed the ring in his left hand away. He held the other up and gazed at Lois's strained, strangely young face through it, as if through a telescope. This is the one. The others are just placeholders, I think, like zeros in a big, complicated math problem. You mean they don't matter? He hesitated, unsure of how to reply. Because they did matter, that was the thing. He just didn't know how to put his intuitive understanding of this into words. As long as the false rings kept appearing in this nasty little room, like hats on the head of Bartholomew Cubbins, the future represented by the death bag around the Civic Center remained the one true future. But the first ring, the one which Atropos had actually stolen off Ed's finger, perhaps as he lay sleeping next to Helen in the little Cape Cod house which was now standing empty, could change all that. The replicas were tokens which preserved the shape of car, just as spokes radiating out from a hub preserved the shape of a wheel. The original, however, Ralph thought the original was the hub. One ring to bind them. He gripped the gold band tightly, feeling its hard curve bite into his palm and fingers. Then he slipped it into his watch pocket. There was one thing about car they didn't tell us, he thought. It's slippery. Slippery as some nasty old fish that won't come off the hook, but just keeps flopping around in your hand. And it was like climbing a sand dune, too. You slid one step back for every two you managed to lunge forward. They had gone out to High Ridge and accomplished something. Just what, Ralph didn't know. But Dorrance had assured them it was true. According to him, they had fulfilled their task there. Now they had come here and taken Ed's token. But it still wasn't enough. And why? Because Carr was like a fish. Carr was like a sand dune. Carr was like a wheel that didn't want to stop, but only to roll on and on, crushing whatever might happen to be in its path. A wheel of many spokes. But most of all, perhaps, Carr was like a ring, like a wedding ring. He suddenly understood what all the talk on the hospital roof and all of Dorrance's efforts to explain hadn't been able to convey. Ed's undesignated status, coupled with Atropos's discovery of the pool